The Guardian.
I'm Robert Winston. I'm Professor of Science and Society at Imperial College and new chair. And this is the Guardian podcast.
I'm going to give a talk which I've entitled Appetite for Destruction. And I'm going to argue that somewhere between 1.5 to 2.5 million years ago, mankind, free humans, invented the hand axe. And I'm going to argue that it's stone which separates us from the rest of the animal kingdom. And what's interesting about that is, of course, we know that the human brain starts to emerge as an increasingly enlarging organ, which is becoming increasingly dominant, way after the hand axe. And it seems that the hand axe, of course, as most paleontologists seem to agree, was a very important influence. What's interesting is our use of tools, therefore, actually influenced our evolution. As a result of having those tools, we hunted in groups, so we needed to communicate, and that improved our intellectual ability. And of course, there's a lot of evidence to suggest that eating meat and the lipids which occur as a result of hunting changed the brain from, let's say, around 950 millilitres to 1.5 or thereabouts millilitres. Now, the reason why that's interesting is because what I'm going to try and demonstrate, every piece of technology that mankind has produced, including that, has been downhill, that actually there's been a forgotten potential for harm. I'm going to argue that every piece of technology which is announced, like you announced at this meeting, invariably is overemphasized at the time of its first announcement. It's always seemed to be more important than it is. Secondly, that it has a downside that we don't recognize at the time. Thirdly, many scientific inventions, their real value is not seen until a long time after they're announced. And that fourthly, as with the hand axe, human inventions occur simultaneously in unconnected parts of the globe in different ways. And that's really interesting. And I'm going to use the example of the atlatl, which is a bow, which is a precursor of the bow and arrow, as an example of that. Now, why that's important may not be at first obvious, but we have increasing evidence that the technologies we're producing are being more and more threatening and are risking our destruction. I don't believe we will destroy ourselves. I think we have reason to be optimistic. But I think in order to be optimistic properly, we need to understand those basic mechanisms. So, for example, it's pointless trying to regulate science in the way that we do it because unconnected events in science occur in Korea, China, South America, as well as in University College London or Imperial College London or Cambridge or wherever. So we have to be much more sophisticated. And it seems to me that one of the key messages here is the need for exactly what the BA is doing at this festival, which essentially is to try, in the course of public engagement, to have a new notion of the citizenship of the scientist, that actually scientists have to be much more demonstrably responsible and responsive for the advantages and the problems which they may present. So, in a sense, it's quite a philosophical lecture, and I'll go through a number of areas. I'll certainly talk about Galileo. I intend to talk about Auschwitz. I will talk about the caves in the Pyrenees where the first signs of human spirituality occurred. And I will talk about the science delusion as opposed to the God delusion. I'll be arguing that actually we cannot any longer have the conventional understanding of genetics which everybody peddles, because now it's increasingly obvious that epigenetics, actually things which influence the genome's function, are much more important than we realized even three years ago. And I'll show some examples of epigenetics actually potentially changing human evolution. And I'll argue that just as the stone hand axe changed our evolution, we now have a new technological power to do that. For example, in the pig transgenic work, clearly, if we really have an efficient way of introducing genes into the genome, which I believe we do have, then of course we could modify human evolution very rapidly. So those are the sorts of themes that I'm intending. I don't quite know how far I'll get with them, because my lectures are always very uncoordinated and poorly organised, but, you know, I'll do my best.
What do you mean by the science delusion? What do you mean by the science delusion?
Well, what I mean by the science delusion is that far too many scientists, including my good friend Richard Dawkins, present science as the truth, present it as factually correct. And actually, of course, that clearly isn't true. And the classic example, which I'll refer to at the end of the talk, is what's going to happen tomorrow. And the more we understand either the Higgs boson is there or isn't there, either way, we haven't got to the truth. What we've got to is an increasing uncertainty. And what's interesting about physics, I think, is that physics is much more comfortable with those sorts of grey areas than we biologists, people like Richard and myself, are. And I think we have to understand that as we start to learn more about the cell and its functions, what we are going to see is, with the million events which occur every second in a cell, we're going to see quantum effects. We're going to see things which actually don't completely make sense. It's obvious that it must be the case. And therefore, I think what we need to be is a good deal less determinist. And we are inclined to be very determinist. I think that's quite an important message, actually. I mean, I know it's very complicated stuff and it's probably not pressworthy, but to me it's interesting as a concept. Well, what I mean by determinist is we talk about there being a gene for obesity or a gene for intelligence or a gene for this or that. There's no such thing. We've never shown any of those genes existing. What we show are trends, traits. Genetics is much more complicated. What we now know from the science of epigenetics is that one of the most important aspects in what makes us what we are is neither straight genes nor straight environment, but actually what happens to us during development. So, for example, in the first few weeks of intrauterine life, the influences on the embryo, and if they're twins, the influences on two embryos, which can be quite different, can have a profound effect on development 50 years later. Classic example is the Barker hypothesis. If you're born 5.5 pounds in weight, your chances of developing heart disease, hypertension, stroke at the age of 55 are much greater than average.
If you're saying that scientists are deluded...
Are deluded? Yeah. No, I'm not saying that. What I'm saying is that scientists claim that other people who don't believe what they say are deluded, and that's what Dawkins does. What Dawkins says is that if you don't believe in the fact that religion is a nonsense, you're deluded. I think that's a very dangerous message. I think it's a very dangerous message because I think, actually, it is irresponsible. I think it poo-poos other people's views of a universe about which none of us know clearly or absolutely. And that is very important. Now, I don't think... In fact, actually, I would argue that the God delusion approach, that approach, is actually very divisive, because it's the one way, surely, of not winning over opposing views. It's clearly going to polarise religious people. It's clearly already polarised scientists. Scientists can now say, well, we've got an excuse. You know, Richard Dawkins has said this, it's fine. Religious people can say, look, these guys just don't understand us. And I think that what we should not be looking for is polarisation, but dialogue. Dialogue has become more difficult since the God delusion. And I think, actually, it's a very risky strategy, especially now. You know, I would argue, and this might you might feel is quotable, that actually, essentially, in my view, the reason why we study science is because we're uncertain. The reason why many of us are religious is because we're uncertain. Uncertainty is something that we live with, and both science and religion, when they are certain, are at their most dangerous. And we saw that with the Manhattan Project to some extent. And we see the obvious examples of religious certainty in 9/11, for example. If you can call that religious certainty. But I mean, you know, jihad. So I would argue that we need to be much more sophisticated in how we handle these problems in our society. And I don't think the propositions of people like Christopher Hitchens, Richard Dawkins, Daniel Dennett, and a number of other writers have really furthered useful, healthy debate. I think actually they've limited it, and that worries me. There's always a risk that if I say things too strongly, then Richard will come out in a cold sweat tomorrow morning because he'll read in the newspapers that Robert Winston has condemned him for being... He's a friend of mine. You know, I really am very fond of Richard Dawkins. I admire him as one of our greatest writers in science, perhaps our greatest writer. And I wouldn't want for a moment to belittle him or undermine him or be unreasonably critical of him. And I understand why he's writing as he does, because he is actually very concerned about the creationists, but I would argue that his strategy is wrong. I don't think it's a helpful strategy. How badly? Well, I mean, just like Richard, I think the creationist movement is shocking. I mean, I think it completely misrepresents what we know to be highly likely to be true. To my mind, that is very harmful. The idea that we should abandon evolution in, you know, in school education strikes me as being immoral. And to have children being taught wrongly, clearly not acceptable in a society like our own. But I don't think battering the creationists on the head will encourage them to change the way they teach children. And that's the issue. I think it makes them more entrenched rather than less.
You mentioned this issue of technologies when they come in, they're overblown or their true significance is not understood. What sort of examples?
Pretty well everything you think of. Ultrasound's a good example. When Ian Donald came back from the war, he was in the Air Force. He started in the lab I now occupy, where I just occupied until it was finally condemned and knocked down. He started to do experiments using sonar to try and identify patterns. And he had no idea that actually it would become the biggest single medical advance of the last decade, really. When Marie Curie started to sift through pitchblende, who could have imagined that actually one of the greatest health-giving advances would be the development of X-rays, X-ray technology, radiology, or for that matter, one of the greatest and most significant weapons we've had either. So I think the significance of inventions is something which gradually emerges. And part of my argument is that, you know, this goes right back to the beginning of technology. As soon as we started farming, we actually started to get problems. It wasn't just the hand axe. Farming resulted in the spread of human disease, the changes in crops environments, the fact that a lot of crops that we previously could take on no longer would survive in difficult environments, that we are much more at the mercy of climate change and so on. It's very clear from the historical record that as soon as we developed cities around 8,000 years ago, the death rate rose. I mean, longevity fell. People lived shorter because of infection. Because then we had to factor in the problems of how you live on the community outside the city and actually how you avoid the water supply being contaminated and all these other factors are gone. And it's gone right through with transport, with energy, you know, with every major technology we developed. Now, I'm not saying for a moment we haven't the capability of overcoming a problem of the city or a problem of energy, but what I'm arguing is that we need to be very thoughtful how we present the things that we do, because we need the public to be on side. We need them absolutely to be in favour of our spending money of theirs on the sort of research which is required to make sure that technology is used well and wisely. Now, you know, I'm on the Engineering and Physical Sciences Research Council. This year we'll be spending close to £1 billion on research in engineering and physical sciences. We've got to show utter responsibility that this is actually money that is really being spent properly. I think we do. I'm rather proud of that research council, but nonetheless, we've got to be answerable, we've got to be accountable. And therefore, I think scientists cannot afford to make ex cathedra statements about, well, I know better than them, because actually I've got the experience and the knowledge which I've learned at university, and these people are a bit ignorant, so I'm going to communicate to them in rather, you know, simple terms which, you know, that's the only way they'll understand. That won't wash in a modern society. People are too sophisticated. And in a democracy, it's not justified either.
This going back to this point about certainty, just sort of imagine Lewis Walpole now getting very upset.
Oh, absolutely. Yes, I'm sure he would, David.
His definition of technology is...
Lewis is the classic person who I'm absolutely implacably opposed to. Mm. I love Lewis. He's a wonderful man. But he's balmy. I mean, you know, he presents science as the total truth. Mm. And, I mean, it's a nonsense. And what's remarkable about Lewis is that Lewis is a really significant scientist. Very bright. I mean, he's got some 20 papers in Nature. I mean, how many scientists at this meeting or any meeting will have that number of papers in Nature? Mm. I certainly haven't.
I mean, he's got this division, hasn't he? He would say what you're talking about isn't science, it's technology.
I know, but you can't do that. You can't do that. The two are interconnected, aren't they? That's the problem. The use of science is dependent on the science that we produce. I think my answer to Lewis has to be that we have to have in mind that when we're doing research, where we can, we have to look forward to see where it might have an application. And in fact, that's very much the view of the research councils. That's what they do. So they've taken that on board. For example, most research councils now even require it in the submission for a project grant for investigators to have some knowledge of what the societal impact of their research might be, i.e. the technology. Now, of course, I'm also clearly presenting a kind of paradox, because I'm also saying, well, you can't always see where that science is leading. But nonetheless, it doesn't mean to say we shouldn't try.
For more discussion and analysis, download Guardian Daily. That's The Guardian's news podcast, available first thing in the morning, Monday to Friday.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.